portions on recording. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And yes, this is Hour of the Wolf. It's not a normal Hour of the Wolf, but I do want to start by promoting the New York Review of Science Fiction event that's going to be coming this Tuesday. I've been under-promoting it, which is a shame because it's our annual December event, and it's a joyous one. It's a wonderful one. And each year, I guess it's like our 11th year or so, we, you know, it's a common thing for places to have a family come and do something as a family. And the family that we have, two wonderful writers married to each other, are Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. Both of them great writers. Ellen is going to be reading an excerpt from Tremontaine and Delia from The Evil Wizard Smallbone. If you know who these people are, this is very cool stuff. Delia was born in Tokyo, Japan, brought to New York, brought up in New York. Her short fiction for adults has appeared mostly, most recently, in the anthologies Naked City and Queen Victoria's Book of Spells. Her middle grade novels include Changeling, The Magic Mirror of the Mermaid Queen, and The Freedom Maids, which was awarded the Norton Award, the Prometheus Award, and the Mythopoeic Award. Her recent collection of short fiction, Young Woman in a Garden, had appeared on Publisher Weekly's list of best science fiction of the year. And let's see, contributing editor for Tor Books, co-edited The Horns of Elfland with Ellen Kushner and Donald G. Keller, and The Essential Border Town. I'm a big fan of all the Border Town books. She is executive editor of Interfictions Online, a journal of interstitial arts, and she teaches writing all over the place. I'm obviously truncating this. Ellen Kushner's first novel was the cult classic Swords Point, which introduced readers to Riverside, the setting she later returned to in The Privilege of the Sword, The Fall of the Kings, written with Delia Sherman, and in a collection of related short stories. Kushner recorded all three novels in audiobook form for Neil Gaiman Presents, which is an imprint at audible.com, and winning the 2012 Audi Award for Swords Point. And a new online collaborative sequel to Swords Point called Tremontaine debuted in fall 2015 with the e-publisher Serial Box and continues with new adventures next year. This is all free, although we do ask for donations at the door. Downstairs in this very building at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue, this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. We used to say doors open at 6:30, and I encourage you to come at 6:30 and meet people and all that. But in fact, the cafe is open all day, so you can come anytime. But 6:30 is a good time to get here, and we'll have a raffle, and we'll have a lot of freebies to give away. December's a good time for stuff on our freebie shelf, which we will be doing. I said this is not going to be an ordinary edition of Hour of the Wolf. And, well, there is sadly reason for that. And here, then, is a piece from the WBAI News from this past Monday.
And finally, WBAI has lost one of its own. Simon Lokely, producer and host of As I Please, was on WBAI airwaves for about 35 years. He passed away in Queens on Saturday of complications from pancreatic cancer. He was 62 years old. Jim Freund has more.
Simon Lokely started out at WBAI in the drama and literature department in the early 80s. Then he settled into freeform radio. locally was a Joycean scholar and member of the James Joyce Society. His radio program was a mix of satirical social observation with readings and literary discussion.
I really have got to say, now, sound a little bit like Dr. Williams there, I've got to tell you that Ovid's narrative skills are absolutely excellent. He knows what to tell us. He knows what not to tell us. He doesn't give us a lot of clutter. He assumes an intelligent reader who is more or less familiar with the territory that's being covered. And just does a wonderful job with occasional touches of Ovidian humor.
Each month, Locally held court at his stand-up academy series at the Swift Hibernian Lounge in the East Village, a classic Irish bar where he spoke to a packed room of devoted fans.
Episode 2 of Ulysses. The schoolroom episode, Nestor. You, Cochrane, what city sent for him? Tarentum, sir.
Outside of WBAI, he penned and drew an ongoing cartoon zine called Dazibow, recent issues of which can be found on his website at simonloekle.com. Simon Locally will be remembered for his unique voice, his wry, acerbic wit, and take-no-prisoners attitude. It can truly be said he did as he pleased. Jim Freund, WBAI News, New York.
A memorial celebration on the life of Simon Locally is being planned for February 2016. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And I have to very much thank Linda for giving me the opportunity to produce that, because when I heard of Simon's death, I don't handle these things well. You know, a year and a half later, I'm not over Margot Adler, never will be. I'm not over Steve Post, etc., etc. And in fact, I wrote a piece on Margot almost exactly a year ago. It took me like 6 months in order to get around to that, and science fiction writer Michael Burstein recommended me to an editor, a woman named Lisa Feld, who was doing who works as an editor on a online zine, and asked me to write a remembrance, which I did, and I'm so grateful for that as well. I'm very pleased. She very much changed what I had initially worked on, as, by the way, did Linda Perry. The final piece that you just heard does not resemble what I initially wrote, because these people do very good jobs, and I respect editors, and these are two who I respect very much. They made it better, which is what the job is supposed to do. I will have more to say about Simon, not so much tonight in this time slot. I will be participating, helping coordinate this week's As I Please, this coming Saturday at 6 a.m., but tune in at 5, because R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North also have a tribute planned, and, you know, just prepare to tune in to WBAI from 5 until 8 a.m. I have been asking a couple of people for input on various things, and here is for those of you who are longtime and devoted listeners to WBAI. I trust you all will remember Kathy O'Connell.
Simon Locally was my friend for over 30 years. We met at WBAI in our early days at the station, where we fell into the group dubbed Reception Riffraff for our late-night gathering place and collective outlook toward life. You'd be amazed at how creative you can get in the middle of the night with like-minded people. Out of the Reception Riffraff grew the Early Morning Radio Alliance, who filled overnights on WBAI for years. Our friendship solidified during a golden age of live radio at WBAI, a time of Lynn Samuels and John Fiske and Paul Wunder and Robert Knight, among other memorable voices now silent. WBAI was our university, and we shared a master class. Simon and I seemed unlikely friends. He was quiet and bookish. I was a loud child of TV. But we bonded over a simple tenet of life. We love to make trouble cause trouble's what we make best. Together, Simon and I were the bad kids' table, a kids' table unto ourselves. We were far from the best-behaved attendees at any event, sometimes fueled by our shared fondness for Manhattan's dive bars. Along with being able to quote Beckett, I can honestly say I drank martinis on the subway, thanks to Simon Locley. We shared a love of the movie All About Eve, called ourselves Addison and Margot, and emptied rooms full of people by spouting quotes from the movie. Max, you sly puss. Within the WBAI family, we saw each other at our worst and at our best. And because we are family, all of it was okay. It was Simon I clung to sobbing when we gathered at WBAI the day after John Lennon's assassination. And it was Simon who I turned to when I needed someone to play Alexander Hamilton. He could get the job done, whatever the job was. We shared a common belief that Claude Rains was the greatest actor of all time. We loved The Simpsons and Tracy Ullman. It was part of the beauty of Simon that he had such a wide range of knowledge, of interests. Not just Joyce and Pound, but Crazy Cat and Sinatra. And because you knew Simon, or even listened to Simon, you became a smarter person. At least, you felt smarter just being around him. His ease with words, his fluidity of expression, these served him well in other media as well. He was an inventive cartoonist, a brilliant stand-up performer. And this man who clung to the written word in its traditional forms embraced social media on his own terms as a means of communication that is simultaneously intimate and impersonal, much like radio. Simon Locley was a craftsman, a wordsmith, a Renaissance man in the truest sense of the word. But most of all, he was my dear friend. Simon lived. And while there will always be a Simon-sized hole in my soul for him, there is comfort in knowing he lived on his own terms. Good night, sweet prince. Take it easy, but take it. For WBAI, as I grieve, I'm Kathy O'Connell.
Thank you, Kathy. Would you believe me if I told you that I shot her a note on Facebook asking if she could record something, and I had that exactly as you just heard it about 40 minutes later. Wow, that's good. Thank you very much, Kathy. There's mention made of a memorial planned in February that is to be specifically Stand-Up Academy. Was Simon's monthly event where he would read, lecture, and hold forth, usually on the classics from, you heard the little bit over there about Ovid. Actually about James Joyce, and you're about to hear that. I'm so pleased that I spent several months, almost a year, recording him there, but it turned out to be often technical issues and things like that, but some of them turned out. Well, he always took a winter break. He took winter off from appearing at the Swift Hibernian Lounge, and the next scheduled Stand-Up Academy is February 22nd of next year. That, if you're a lover of Simon Locley's work, poetry, and brilliance be there. That will be the memorial. Again, February 22nd at the Swift Hibernian Lounge on East 4th Street. So more information on that as we get closer to it. So let us listen to one of those meetings at Stand Up Academy. Simon always said that these events would begin at 7 o'clock sharp. Well, yeah, right. Just like my event this Tuesday will begin at 7 o'clock sharp. And it doesn't work that way, especially in a pub. So let's tune in to one of these. Bear with me, I'm queuing up the wrong thing. And let's get the correct one going. Yeah. Like a fool took off my glasses. Where are we here? Here we are.
And the time is now 7:37. And good evening and welcome aboard for this post-Bloomsday show for 28th of June. How time flies. Does everybody feel reasonably content? I don't ask for much. This evening I will read an episode from Ulysses, the second episode, Nestor. And over the past few weeks I have made connections between Nestor and a curious genre of the novel, the school book, a book which takes place at a school. Seems pretty simple when you think of it. And A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is a very fine example of the genre. But here, in this brief episode in Ulysses, Joyce takes it a bit further by the introduction of realism. And one of the aspects of this realism presents a classroom where the frustration and the distraction of both teacher and students is very clear. Stephen is not a brilliant teacher. The students are not extraordinarily bright. This is the way of the world. The art of the episode, and in Joyce's famous scheme of things of Ulysses, every episode has its art. And the art of this episode is history. And consequently, it begins with an historical session. But the presence of history is a little more subtle than that. There are lots of different ways of approaching the question of history, and Joyce touches upon a lot of them in the course of this episode. But one of the things which I find most important to stress here is the social activity of Ulysses, the people we meet. We meet tons of people in the course of, and I mean tons literally, because some of them are heavy set. We meet tons of people in the course of this book. And it is an important balance to the notable feature of Ulysses, the interior monologue. That though we spend a good deal of time with Stephen and Bloom and eventually even Molly inside their heads, they are social creatures. And one of the things in my most recent reading of the Penelope episode is just thinking of all the times that she is quoting someone and how that affects her voice. If she remembers these people speaking it, should it not be that person's voice? And so too throughout Stephen and Bloom's interior monologues, even there inside their heads we are meeting people. And it is this social quality of Ulysses that makes it so much fun and why Joyceans are really such fine people, such fun people. Not me. But many other choices. One of the things that I notice in rereading this episode is a quality of repetition. Now, if you are a writer, or if you know a writer, you know that the Iowa School of Famous Writers generally prescribes that you do not repeat words on the same page. That variety is the main thing. And Joyce simply seems to be breaking this rule. And it is a really wonderful quality of repetition as one, I think, pointing out the fact that Stephen is not in his best form at this time of day. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, a Thursday morning. Also, it represents part of that art of history of the episode. That history repeats itself. And one thing is the snail image. Shortly after I begin reading, we get to a moment where the word snail crops up. And then rapidly, in the course of 12 lines, it comes again and again. To a persnickety writer, this repetition is wrong. But for Joyce, it is a wonderful way of evoking that stage of human development. And then the schoolboy, with his shining morning face creeping like snail unwillingly to school. Joyce doesn't make a point of it. I'm not trying to prove anything. And yet, snail, 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 and a living snail at that. Or the way Joyce describes Deasy as old. In the course of 30 lines or so, maybe half a dozen times, Deasy as being old. There are lots of words to describe old. Joyce wanted to keep this just as something that we can recognize and also something which is not laden with value judgments. Things are old, as is Deasy. This is a more difficult point to bring up, and that is whether or not anyone would ever describe this episode as beautiful. And yet, it is beautiful writing. We are in the presence of a master. And some of the great things of Joyce are things that you might just slip by you in the course of hearing it being read to you. As, for example, when Stephen is dealing with Sargent, his student, Cyril Sargent, he notices an ink stain on his face. A date-shaped ink stain. And in an episode where history is the art, and where we have seen these students just going through a history session, this date-shaped ink stain is just wonderful. It's the sort of thing that only Joyce could do. Well, I suppose there's no help for it but to get down to work, eh? But the first part of the work is the passing of the can. Now, I just want to make this very, very clear that not one cent raised here tonight will go to that stinking hellhole on Wall Street, WBAI. This all goes to my cat, Popeye.
We're not on Wall.
Having made that clear, I would now like to thank those here at the Swift who make this possible, and the golfers who came and left very quickly. We're all surprised about that. And, of course, the lovely and delightful Caleb, the finest waitress in the universe, and, frankly, the cat's meow. And so now comes the serious part of the business, the passing of the can.
Donations, which is the only remuneration that he would get for Stand Up Academy. on these evenings. And then, well, this takes a while. It's a nice-sized room, and he would pack those rooms, let me tell you that. So let's wait for him to get back to the podium. A huge, wonderful podium that almost looked like a Dalek, for those of you who are familiar. It sounds like he might be getting ready.
The wall of
defense.
Ah,
yes, he is. Nope. More temporal stuff. I'm sorry for not having fully
is what we
edited
live for.
This.
This is why we are on Earth, to enjoy that quality of attention that art brings to things.
Okay,
and
let's get
Joyce
back now.
Is the best. Episode 2 of Ulysses, the schoolroom episode. Nestor. You, Cochrane, what city sent for him? Tarentum, sir. Very good. Well, there was a battle, sir. Very good. Where? The boy's blank face asked the blank window. Fabled by the daughters of memory. And yet it was in some way, if not as memory fabled it. A phrase then of impatience, thud of Blake's wings of excess. I hear the ruin of all space, shattered glass, and toppling masonry, and time, one livid final flame. What's left us, then? I forget the place, sir. 279 B.C. Asculum, Stephen said, glancing at the name and date in the gore-scarred book. Yes, sir. And he said, another victory like that, and we are done for. That phrase the world had remembered. A dull ease of the mind. From a hill above a corpse-strewn plain, a general, speaking to his officers, leaned upon his spear. Any general to any officers, they lend ear. You, Armstrong, Stephen said, what was the end of Pyrrhus? End of Pyrrhus, sir? I know, sir. Ask me, sir, Common said. Wait. You, Armstrong, do you know anything about Pyrrhus? A bag of fig rolls lay snugly in Armstrong's satchel. He curled them between his palms at whiles and swallowed them softly. Crumbs adhered to the tissue of his lips. A sweetened boy's breath. Well-off people, proud that their eldest son was in the Navy. Vico Road, Dalkey. Pyrrhus, sir. Pyrrhus, appear. All laughed. Mirthless, high, malicious laughter. Armstrong looked round at his classmates, silly glee in profile. In a moment, they will laugh more loudly, aware of my lack of rule and of the fees their papas pay. Tell me now, Stephen said, poking the boy's shoulder with the book. What is a peer? A peer, sir, Armstrong said. A thing out in the water. A kind of bridge. Kingstown Pier, sir. Some laughed again, mirthless, but with meaning. Two in the back bench whispered. Yes. They knew,
had never learned nor ever been innocent. All. With envy, he watched their faces. Edith, Ethel, Gertie, Lily. Their likes, their breaths too, sweetened with tea and jam, their bracelets tittering in the struggle. Kingstown Pier, Stephen said. Yes, a disappointed bridge. The words troubled their gaze. How, sir? Common asked. A bridge is across a river. For Haynes's chapbook, no one here to hear. Tonight, deftly, amid wild drink and talk, to pierce the polished mail of his mind. What then? A jester at the court of his master, indulged and disesteemed, winning a clement master's praise. Why had they chosen all that part? Not wholly for the smooth caress. For them, too, history was a tale like any other, too often heard. Their land, a pawn shop. Had Pyrrhus not fallen by a beldam's hand in Argos, or Julius Caesar not been knifed to death, they are not to be thought away. Time has branded them, and fettered they are lodged in the room of the infinite possibilities they have ousted. But can those have been possible, seeing that they never were? Or was that only possible which came to pass? Weaver of the wind. Tell us a story, sir. Oh, do, sir. A ghost story. Where do you begin in this? Stephen asked, opening another book. Weep no more, Common said. Go on then, Talbot. And the story, sir?
After, Stephen said.
Go on, Talbot. A swarthy boy opened a book and propped it nimbly under the breastwork of his satchel. He recited jerks of verse with odd glances at the text. Weep no more, woeful shepherds. Weep no more. For Lycidas, your sorrow, is not dead, sunk though he be beneath the watery floor. It must be a movement, then, an actuality of the possible as possible. Aristotle's phrase formed itself within the gabbled verses and floated out into the studious silence of the library of Saint Genevieve, where he had read, sheltered from the sin of Paris, night by night. By his elbow, a delicate Siamese conned a handbook of strategy. Fed and feeding brains about me, under glow lamps, impaled with faintly beating feelers, and in my mind's darkness, a sloth of the underworld, reluctant, shy of brightness, shifting her dragon-scaly folds. Thought is the thought of thought. Tranquil brightness. The soul is, in a manner, all that is. The soul is the form of forms. Tranquility, sudden, vast, candescent, form of forms. Talbot repeated, through the dear might of him that walked the waves, through the dear might, turn over, Stephen said quietly. I don't see anything. What, sir? Talbot asked simply, bending forward. His hand turned the page over. He leaned back and went on again, having just remembered of him that walked the waves. Here also over these craven hearts his shadow lies, and on the scoffer's heart and lips, and on mine. It lies upon their eager faces who offered him a coin of the tribute. To Caesar, what is Caesar's? To God, what is God's? A long look from dark eyes, a riddling sentence to be woven and woven on the chirp's looms. Aye. Riddle me, Randy Rowe. My father gave me seeds to sow. Talbot slid his closed book into his satchel. Have I heard all? Stephen asked. Yes, sir. Hockey at 10, sir. Half day, sir. Thursday. Who can answer a riddle? Stephen asked. They bundled their books away, pencils clacking, pages rustling. Crowding together, they strapped and buckled their satchels, all gabbling gaily. A riddle, sir. Ask me, sir. Oh, ask me, sir. A hard one, sir. This is the riddle, Stephen said. The cock crew, the sky was blue. The bells in heaven were striking 11. 'Tis time for this poor soul to go to heaven. What is that? What, sir? Again, sir, we didn't hear. Their eyes grew bigger as the lines were repeated. After a silence, Cochran said, what is it, sir? We give it up. Stephen, his throat itching, answered, the fox burying his grandmother under a holly bush. He stood up and gave a shout of nervous laughter, to which their cries echoed dismay. A stick struck the door, and a voice in the corridor called, Hockey! They broke asunder, sidling out of their benches, leaping them. Quickly they were gone, and from the lumber room came the rattle of sticks and clamor of their boots and tongues. Sergeant, who alone had lingered, came forward slowly, showing an open copybook. His thick hair and scraggy neck gave witness of unreadiness, and through his misty glasses, weak eyes looked up, pleading. On his cheek, dull and bloodless, a soft stain of ink lay, date-shaped, recent and damp as a snail's bed. He held out his copybook. The word sums was written on the headline. Beneath were sloping figures, and at the foot a crooked signature with blind loops and a blot. Cyril Sargent, his name and seal. And Mr. Deasy told me to write them out all again, he said, and show them to you, sir. Stephen touched the edges of the book. Futility. Do you understand how to do them now? He asked.
Numbers 11 to 15, Sergeant answered. Mr. Deasy said I was to copy them off the board, sir.
Can you do them yourself? Stephen asked.
No, sir.
Ugly and futile. Lean neck and thick hair and a stain of ink. A snail's bed. Yet someone had loved him, borne him in her arms and in her heart. But for her, the race of the world would have trampled him underfoot, a squashed, boneless snail. She had loved his weak, watery blood drain from her own. Was that then real? The only true thing in life? His mother's prostrate body, the fiery Columbanus in holy zeal bestrode. She was no more. The trembling skeleton of a twig burnt in the fire, an odor of rosewood and wetted ashes. She had saved him from being trampled underfoot and had gone, scarcely having been. A poor soul gone to heaven, and on a heath beneath winking stars, a fox, red reek of rapine in his fur, with merciless bright eyes scraped in the earth, listened, scraped up the earth, listened, scraped and scraped. Sitting at his side, Stephen solved up the problem. He proves by algebra that Shakespeare's ghost is Hamlet's grandfather. Sergeant peered askance through his slanted glasses. Hockey sticks rattled in the lumber room, the hollow knock of a ball, and calls from the field. Across the page, the symbols moved in grave morris, in the mummery of their letters, wearing quaint caps of squares and cubes. Give hands, traverse, bow to partner, so, imps of fancy of the moors. Gone too from the world, Averroes and Moses Maimonides, dark men in mien and movement, flashing in their mocking mirrors the obscure soul of the world, a darkness shining in brightness which brightness could not comprehend. Do you understand now? Can you work the second for yourself? Yes, sir. In long, shaky strokes, Sergeant copied the data. Waiting always for a word of help, his hand moved faithfully the unsteady symbols, a faint hue of shame flickering behind his dull skin. Amor matris, subjective and objective genitive. With her weak blood and whey-sour milk, she had fed him and hid from sight of others his swaddling bands. Like him was I, these sloping shoulders, this gracelessness. My childhood bends beside me. Too far from me to lay a hand there once or lightly. Mine is far, and his secret is our eyes. Secrets, silent, stony, sit in the dark palaces of both our hearts. Secrets weary of their tyranny. Tyrants willing to be dethroned. The sum was done. It is very simple, Stephen said as he stood up. Yes, sir. Thanks, Sergeant answered. He dried the page with a sheet of thin blotting paper and carried his copybook back to his bench. You had better get your stick and go out to the others, Stephen said as he followed towards the door, the boy's graceless form. Yes, sir. In the corridor, his name was heard, called from the playfield. Sergeant! Oh, run on, Stephen said. Mr. Deasy is calling you. He stood in the porch and watched the laggard hurry towards the scrappy field where sharp voices were in strife. They were sorted in teams, and Mr. Deasy came away stepping over wisps of grass with gaitered feet. When he had reached the schoolhouse, voices again contending called to him. He turned his angry white mustache. "What is it now?" he cried continually without listening.
"Cochrane and Halliday are on the same side, sir," Stephen said.
"Will you wait in my study for a moment," Mr. Deasy said, "till I restore order here?" And as he stepped fussily back across the field, his old man's voice cried sternly, "What is the matter? What is it now?" Their sharp voices cried about him on all sides. Their many forms closed round him, the garish sunshine bleaching the honey of his ill-dyed head. Stale, smoky air hung in the study, with the smell of drab, abraded leather of its chairs. As on the first day, he bargained with me here. As it was in the beginning, it is now. On the sideboard, the tray of Stuart coins, base treasure of a bog, and ever shall be. And snug in their spoon case of purple plush, faded, the 12 apostles having preached to all the Gentiles, world without end. A hasty step over the stone porch and in the corridor. Blowing out his rare mustache, Mr. Deasy halted at the table.
First, our little financial settlement, he said.
He brought out of his coat a pocketbook bound by a leather thong. It slapped open, and he shook from it two notes, one of joined halves, and laid them carefully on the table. Two, he said, strapping and stowing his pocketbook away. And now his strong room for the gold. Stephen's embarrassed hand moved over the shells heaped in the cold stone mortar, whelks and money cowries and leopard shells. And this whirled as an emir's turban, and this the scallop of St. James. An old pilgrim's hoard, dead treasure, hollow shells. A sovereign fell, bright and new, on the soft pile of the tablecloth. Three, Mr. Deasy said, turning his little savings box about in his hand. These are handy things to have. See, this is for sovereigns. This is for shillings, sixpences, half crowns, and here, crowns. See? He shot from it 2 crowns and 2 shillings. 3 12, he said. I think you'll find that's right.
Thank you, sir, Stephen said, gathering the money together with shy haste and putting it all in a pocket of his trousers.
No thanks at all, Mr. Deasy said. You have earned it.
Stephen's hand, free again, went back to the hollow shells. Symbols, too, of beauty and of power. A lump in my pocket. Symbols soiled by greed and misery.
Don't carry it like that, Mr. Deasy said. You'll pull it out somewhere and lose it. You just buy one of these machines. You'll find them very handy.
Answer something. Mine would be often empty, Stephen said.
The same room and hour, the same wisdom, and I the same. 3 times now. 3 nooses round me here. Well, I can break them in this instant, if I will.
Because you don't save, Mr. Deasy said, pointing his finger. You don't know yet what money is. Money is power. When you have lived as long as I have, I know, if youth but knew. But what does Shakespeare say? Put but money in thy purse.
Iago, Stephen murmured. He lifted his gaze from the idle shells to the old man's stare.
Well, he knew what money was, Mr. Deasy said. He made money. A poet, yes, but an Englishman, too. Do you know what is the pride of the English? Do you know what is the proudest word you will ever hear from an Englishman's mouth?
The sea's ruler, his sea-cold eyes look down the empty bay. It seems history is to blame on me and on my words, unhating.
On his empire, Stephen said, the sun never sets.
Bah! Mr. Deasy cried. That's not English! A French Celt said that.
He tapped his savings box against his thumbnail.
I will tell you, he said solemnly, what is his proudest boast? I paid my way.
Good man. Good man.
I paid my way. I never borrowed a shilling in my life. Can you feel that? I owe nothing. Can you?
Mulligan, £9. 3 pairs of socks. 1 pair of brogues. Ties. Curran, 10 guineas. McCann, 1 guinea. Fred Ryan, 2 shillings. Temple, 2 lunches. Russell, 1 guinea. Cousins, 10 shillings. Bob Reynolds, 1/2 guinea. Cooler, 3 guineas. Mrs. McKiernan, a 5 weeks' board. The lump I have is useless. For the moment, no, Stephen answered.
Mr. Deasy laughed with rich delight, putting back his savings box. I knew you couldn't, he said joyously. But one day you must feel it. We are a generous people, but we must also be just.
I fear those big words, Stephen said, which make us so unhappy. Mr. Deasy stared sternly for some moments over the mantelpiece at the shapely bulk of a man in tartan filibegs. Albert Edward, Prince of Wales.
You think me an old fogey and an old Tory, his thoughtful voice said. I saw 3 generations since O'Connell's time. I remember the famine in 1946. Do you know that the Orange Lodges agitated for repeal of the Union 20 years before O'Connell did, or before the prelates of your communion denounced him as a demagogue? You Fenians forget some things.
Glorious, pious, and immortal memory. The Lodge of Diamond in Armagh, the splendid, behung with corpses of papishes. Horse, masked, and armed, the Planter's Covenant, the Black North, and True Blue Bible. Crappies, lie down.
Stephen sketched a brief gesture.
I have rebel blood in me, too, Mr. Deasy said, on the spindle side. But I am descended from Sir John Blackwood, who voted for the Union. We are all Irish, all king's sons.
Alas, Stephen said.
Per vias rectus,
Mr. Deasy said firmly, was his motto. He voted for it and put on his top boots to ride to Dublin from the Ards of Down to do so.
La, the ra, the ra, the rocky road to Dublin.
A gruff squire on horseback with shiny top boots.
Soft day, Sir John. Soft day, Your Honor. Day, day.
Two top boots jog dangling on to Dublin.
La, the ra, the ra, day. La, the ra, the day.
That reminds me, Mr. Deasy said. You can do me a favor, Mr. Daedalus, with some of your literary friends. I have a letter here for the press. Sit down a moment. I have just to copy the end.
He went to the desk near the window, pulled in his chair twice, and read off some words from the sheet on the drum of his typewriter.
Sit down. Excuse me, he said over his shoulder. The dictates of common sense. Just a moment.
He peered from under his shaggy brows at the manuscript by his elbow, and, muttering, began to prod the stiff buttons of the keyboard slowly, sometimes blowing as he screwed up the drum to erase an error. Stephen seated himself noiselessly before the princely presence. Framed around the walls, images of vanished horses stood in homage, their meek heads poised in air. Lord Hastings' repulse, the Duke of Westminster's shot over, the Duke of Beaufort's salon, Prix de Paris, 1866. Elfin riders sat them, watchful of a sign. He saw their speeds, backing King's colors, and shouted with the shouts of vanished crowds.
Full stop, Mr. Deasy bet his keys. But prompt ventilation of this all-important question.
Where Cranley led me to get rich quick, hunting his winners among the mud-splashed breaks, amid the balls of bookies on their pitches, and reek of the canteen over the motley slush.
Fair rebel, fair rebel. Even money the favorite, 10-1 the field.
Dicers and thimble riggers, we hurried by after the hoofs, the vine caps and jackets, and past the meat-faced woman, a butcher's dame, nuzzling thirstily her clove of orange.
Shouts rang shrill from the boys' playfield, and a whirring whistle. Again, a goal. I am among them, among their battling bodies in a medley, the joust of life.
You mean that knock-kneed mother's darling who seems to be slightly cross-sick?
Jousts. Time-shocked rebounds, shock by shock. Jousts, slush, and uproar of battles, the frozen death spew of the slain, a shout of spear spikes baited with men's bloodied guts.
Now then, Mr. Deasy said, rising. He came to the table, pinning together his sheets.
Stephen stood up.
I have put the matter into a nutshell, Mr. Deasy said. It's about the foot and mouth disease. Just look through it. There can be no two opinions on the matter.
May I trespass on your valuable space? That doctrine of laissez-faire, which so often in our history, our cattle trade, the way of all our industries, Liverpool Ring, which jockeyed the Galway Harbour scheme. European conflagration. Grain supplies through the narrow waters of the Channel. The pluto-perfect imperturbability of the Department of Agriculture. Pardoned a classical allusion. Cassandra, by a woman who was no better than she should be, to come to the point at issue.
I don't mince words, do I?
Mr. Deasy asked, as Stephen read on.
Foot and mouth disease, known as Koch's preparation, serum and virus, percentage of salted horses, rinderpest, emperor's horses at Mürzsteg, Lower Austria, veterinary surgeons, Mr. Henry Blackwood Price, courteous offer, a fair trial, dictates of common sense, all important question, in every sense of the word, take the bull by the horns. Thanking you for the hospitality of your columns.
I want that to be printed and read, Mr. Deasy said. You will see at the next outbreak, they will put an embargo on Irish cattle. And it can be cured. It is cured. My cousin, Blackwood Price, writes to me it is regularly treated and cured in Austria by cattle doctors there. They offer to come over here. I am trying to work up influence with the department. Now, I am going to try publicity. I am surrounded by difficulties, by intrigues, by backstair influence, by...
He raised his forefinger and beat the air oldly before his voice spoke.
Mark my words, Mr. Daedalus, he said. England is in the hand of the Jews. In all the highest places, her finance her press, and they are the signs of a nation's decay. Wherever they gather, they eat up the nation's vital strength. I have seen it coming these years. As sure as we are standing here, the Jew merchants are already at the work of destruction. Old England is dying.
He stepped swiftly off, his eyes coming to blue life as they passed a broad sunbeam. He faced about and back again.
Dying, he said again, if not dead by now.
The harlots cry from street to street, shall weave old England's winding sheet.
His eyes opened wide in vision, stared sternly across the sunbeam in which he halted.
A merchant, Stephen said, is one who buys cheap and sells dear. Jew or Gentile, is he not?
They sinned against the light, Mr. Deasy said gravely, and you can see the darkness in their eyes. And that is why they are wanderers on the earth to this day.
On the steps of the Paris Stock Exchange, the gold-skinned men quoting prices on their gemmed fingers. Gabble of geese. They swarmed loud, uncouth about the temple, their heads thick plotting under maladroit silk hats. Not theirs, these clothes, this speech, these gestures. Their full, slow eyes belied the words, the gestures eager and unoffending, but knew the rancors massed about them, and knew their zeal was vain. Vain patience to heap and hoard. Time surely would scatter all. A hoard heaped by roadside, plundered and passing on. Their eyes knew their years of wandering, and, patient, knew the dishonors of their flesh.
Who has not? Stephen asked.
What do you mean?
Mr. Deasy said. He came forward a pace and stood by the table. His underjaw fell sideways open, uncertainly.
Is this old wisdom?
He waits to hear from me.
History, Stephen said, is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. From the playfield, the boys raised a shout, a whirring whistle.
Goal!
What if that nightmare gave you a back kick?
The ways of the Creator are not our ways, Mr. Deasy said. All human history moves towards one great goal, the manifestation of God.
Stephen jerked his thumb towards the window, saying, that is God.
Hooray! Ah! Whee!
What?
Mr. Deasy asked. A shout in the street, Stephen answered, shrugging his shoulders. Mr. Deasy looked down and held for a while the wings of his nose tweaked between his fingers. Looking up again, he set them free.
I am happier than you are, he said. We have committed many errors and many sins. A woman brought sin into the world. For a woman who was no better than she should be, Helen, the runaway wife of Menelaus, 10 years the Greeks made war on Troy. A faithless wife first brought the strangers to our shore here, McMurra's wife and her Laman O'Rourke, prince of Bethany. A woman, too, brought Tarnal low. Many errors, many failures, but not the one sin. I am a struggler now at the end of my days, but I will fight for the right till the end.
For Ulster will fight, and Ulster will be right. Stephen raised the sheets in his hand.
Oh, well, sir,
he began.
I foresee, Mr. Deasy said, that you will not remain here very long at this work. You were not born to be a teacher, I think. Perhaps I'm wrong.
A learner, rather, Stephen said. And here, what will you learn more? Mr. Deasy shook his head.
Who knows, he said. To learn, one must be humble. But life is the great teacher.
Stephen rustled the sheets again.
As regards these, he began. Yes, Mr. Deasy said, you have 2 copies there. If you can have them published at once.
Telegraph, Irish Homestead.
I will try, Stephen said, and let you know tomorrow. I know 2 editors slightly.
That will do, Mr. Deasy said briskly.
I wrote last night to Mr. Field, MP. There is a meeting of the Cattle Traders Association today at the City Arms Hotel. I asked him to lay my letter before the meeting. You see if you can get it into your 2 papers. What are they?
The Evening Telegraph.
Oh, that will do, Mr. Deasy said. There is no time to lose. Now, I have to answer that letter from my cousin.
Good morning, sir, Stephen said, putting the sheets in his pocket. Thank you.
Not at all,
Mr. Deasy said, as he searched the papers on his desk.
I like to break a lance with you, old as I am.
Good morning, sir, Stephen said again, bowing to his bent back. He went out by the open porch and down the gravel path under the lion's couchant on the pillars as they passed out through the gate. Toothless terrors. Still, I will help him in his fight. Mulligan will dub me a new name, the Bullock Befriending Bard.
And Mr. Daedalus?
Running after me. No more letters, I hope.
Just one moment.
Yes, sir, Stephen said, turning back at the gate. Mr. Deasy halted, breathing hard and swallowing his breath.
I just wanted to say, he said, Ireland, they say,
has the honor of being the only country which never persecuted the Jews. Do you know that? No. And do you know why?
He frowned sternly on the bright air. Why, sir? Stephen asked, beginning to smile.
Because she never let them in, Mr. Deasy said solemnly.
A cough ball of laughter leaped from his throat, dragging after it a rattling chain of phlegm. He turned back quickly, coughing, laughing, his lifted arms waving to the air.
She never let them in, he cried again,
through his laughter as he stamped on gaitered feet over the gravel of the path.
That's why!
On his wise shoulders, through the checkerwork of leaves, the sun flung spangles, dancing coins.
Thank you very much. This has been Stand Up Academy. To my left, people who would like to inform you about the WBAI election.
Simon Lokely at Stand Up Academy, somewhere post Bloomsday of 2010. And as mentioned, Simon passed away at 1:50 in the morning this past Saturday morning as he was getting up and getting ready to come here to do his program As I Please. And we're all in a little bit of shock and mourning and laughing at, you know, cool stories and things like that. And I thought you should all hear that and say, and don't even begin to get me started on, well, is James Joyce, is Ulysses science fiction and fantasy? Well, duh, yes it is. And Simon could have, and occasionally did, lecture people on exactly why that was true when he would fill in for me or when I would fill in for him. This Saturday morning at 6 a.m., when As I Please is scheduled to be on the air, it will be on the air, but not with Simon. I am helping to coordinate a bunch of snippets of radio provided by Max Schmid and Kathy O'Connell, R. Paul Martin and Sharon will be doing their tribute starting at 5 a.m. and they're going to cross over into As I Please at 6 a.m. So please do tune in this week. There will be a memorial for Simon at the Swift Hibernian Lounge, where that was recorded, on February 22nd at 7 p.m., which would have been the next edition of Stand Up Academy. And this is, of course, Lester Young, the Prez, one of Simon's favorite musicians and pieces of music, and I had to choose These Foolish Things Remind Me of You because it seemed the appropriate piece of music to play. Sorry, Simon, the Sinatra, I like jazz Sinatra. I wasn't into, you know, the New York, New York, or My Way Sinatra. That's not my Sinatra. Simon loved Sinatra irregardless of what Sinatra it was. I like Sinatra with Dorsey. I like Sinatra with George Shearing. I like Sinatra when he was a stylist and a singer. Last night on TCM, they were showing Pal Joey, and he does some good songs in that one. But get to the 60s and the Capitol Record era. Yeah, he's fun with Guys and Dolls and the various things that he records with, you know, El Dino and El Sammy and Joey Bishop and all those people, but hardly any women. But they're not the same. They're not, you know, to me, they're not like the really cool, wonderful music that Sinatra did. Simon liked it all, unmitigatingly. And when I filled in for Simon on Why the Wolf Hasn't Come, you see, he did a show called Why the Revolution Hasn't Come from 5 to 8:30 a.m. And then Hour of the Wolf, which was a weekday show, was moved into Saturday mornings and moved into Simon's slot. So I was then 5 to 7 a.m. and he was 7 to 8:30 a.m. This is a configuration that lasted about from 1983 till about 4 years ago. And so when he was out, I filled in for him. When I was out, he filled in for me. And so since the original show was Why the Revolution Hasn't Come, when one of us filled in for the other, or we did a show together, which would occasionally happen, it was called Why the Wolf Hasn't Come. So that's the hybrid of those two shows. So I hope you'll join us. Here's something that we haven't been able to do in bleeping ages. We can take phone calls if you'd like to call up and discuss this morning's show. The new telephone number here for calling on the air is 718-780-8888. Sounds like you've had a full meal. 8888. Let's see. Now, where on this thingy? This says phone. I bet it's probably one of these two, and one would have to press that down. But since nobody's calling in at the moment, it doesn't matter anyway. 718-780-8888. I'm doing that as much for me as anybody else because I have to memorize that phone number. Okay, BAI, I think you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Just wanted to thank you very much for that broadcast. One of my wishes was to one time get to see one of those performances at stand-up, but I never made it over there, and obviously now never have the opportunity, so I really appreciate you playing that.
Yeah, fortunately, I got about 8 of those.
That's great.
And they will be on the air, mostly Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. for the next couple of months.
Oh, that's the station manager has agreed to keep that slot open for a while?
The program director.
The program director.
Yes, Jeannie Hopper.
Okay, so you will be, you said, over the next few months.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the only person inputting into there, but Max Schmid has material, I have material, obviously Simon's ex-wife has material. So we'll be putting, Simon will continue to be on these airwaves as an echo of nothing else for the time being.
That's great. One question I was curious about, just his knowledge was so vast about Joyce and Whitman and Melville. I was just curious.
And science fiction and Tom Stoppard. And he and I had a lot in common.
So I was just curious about his educational background. Did he have a master's degree or a PhD in English literature or American literature, or was he self-taught?
He's mostly self-taught. I don't know what his degree was. I will get more information very soon. But I'm not aware of any degrees that he held. And if you asked him directly, obviously there would be a pun about, I have a degree of... Well, you can imagine his wit.
Right, but
on that.
You think he was more or less self-taught or self-educated?
Yes. I mean, when it comes to Joyce, the answer is you read it, you read it, you write about it, you read it. He was a member of the Joyce Society. He published a great deal about it in scholarly journals, but they never said Simon Locke has a degree in this or that. They would say he's a Joyce scholar, but he was more than a Joyce scholar. He was
also knew Beckett. Right, he also knew about John Milton and Shakespeare and Dante, of course.
Yes, of course, he ran the Shakespeare Liberation Front here at WBAI, where he directed about three plays, making sure they were as obscure as possible. Like, he did a full-fledged radio production of Coriolanus, and I don't remember. I think he did about three, but I just loved the name the Shakespeare Liberation Front.
Yeah, and also his taste in music was terrific. And I regret...
when it came to the prez, when it came to bebop jazz, when it came to certain things, I wholeheartedly agree. When it came to the Gypsy Kings version of Ape Man versus the Kinks, he and I have a certain amount of, shall we say, dissension. And when it comes to... Sinatra clicking his fingers and singing Old MacDonald Had a Chick, E-I-E-I-O. I'm sorry, I drew the line there, but Simon loved it.
Well, I just saw a documentary produced by Sarah Fischko about this photographer, Eugene Smith.
Ooh, I have to see that.
Yeah, it was at the Doc New York Festival.
Yeah.
And I wanted to send an email to Simon because they mentioned about Little Rudy Tootie, the Thelonious Monk song.
Yes.
That it was rehearsed, and they did several iterations in this guy's loft, Eugene Smith's loft, with Thelonious Monk was rehearsing there. And I didn't get around to sending it to him, and I don't know if he would have responded, but... I just thought that was neat because I first learned the song from Simon.
Send it to Janice Coleman, who wrote a book about Charlie Mingus called Mingus Mingus.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Simon was a master of understanding bebop, but not exclusive among our WBAI staff. Janet Coleman knows that stuff and knew some of the people. So, and I've worked with Charles Mingus the third, Charles Mingus Jr.'s son.
Right.
He's been on the show. But
I really appreciate what you did tonight, and I look forward to this special coming up this coming Saturday. And like you said, a couple more Saturdays. Even during the fundraising drive, they'll still keep that space open, you think?
I believe that will be the case, although if I'm involved, I would feel really awkward about pitching off of that slot.
Right. But I know that.
So I don't know about that. All I do know is that I had a conversation with our program director, and she said that we are going to maintain a presence of Simon in his time slot over the next several weeks.
Several weeks, you said.
At least.
Right. Well, that's great. And I got to say, just to echo what you said earlier, I mean, so many people we've lost, you know, like you said, Margot and Steve Post, Robert Knight, of course, and Ibrahim Gonzalez. And it's just tragic, you know, losing all these people. But at least we still have their recordings, right? Their air checks.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm just angry. I don't deal with this stuff well at all. My way of dealing with this stuff is very infantile and poor.
Right. Well, I'm depressed in general with my life, but losing these people, though, it really it's a real gut, real hit in the gut. So I just wanted to thank you for lifting my spirits a little bit. And,
okay, well,
thank you again, Jim.
Take care.
Pleasure. Have a great night.
You too.
Care. Bye.
Okay, and there is a phone ringing in here. I'm not quite sure how to deal with that, because it's this other phone, the Iwatsu phone, which sounds more like a suggestion or something. I assume that's something similar to what we had as a hotline. Do you know anything about this phone, Lister? Well, neither do I. I suspect Max. I says, you know, because he knows the ins and outs of this room. It is 2:56. I will be getting off the air shortly. I do not feel like this has been an hour of the wolf, so I'm not going to be playing Sales of Silver, but we do have another call coming in. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello?
Yes, good morning. When was Simon's birthday?
I don't recall the exact date. It was early September of 1953.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, he is almost exactly 2.5 months younger than I. No, older than I. What am I saying? Older than I. I'm December 30th. That would be our program director's birthday. I don't know why I know that. I saw that somewhere today. I know why, because I was looking something up. And let me tell you something, Google gives out just way too much information about certain things. So what can I say about that? Let me see. There we are. I mustn't forget my keys. My keys are what I play off of. There's a 32 gig thumb drive on those keys. 64 gig, actually. Yeah, another call. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Okay, I'll turn that off.
I'm off the air in 2 minutes.
I think the WBAI website thing said 1954.
Ah, so the scamp was younger than me, huh?
I don't know which is accurate.
It said he was 62 years old, and I will be 62 this month.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I don't know which is correct.
There's that discrepancy.
If he was born in 54, then he was 61. If he was born, but I read elsewhere from an equally unreliable source that he that he was 62. So I simply assumed that it was 1953 and that he and I shared a year.
I'm not going to argue, because usually when I argue with you, I lose.
I have no idea, which is correct, you know.
Well, okay, so do you mind if I lose this time, too?
Oh, no. Okay, fine, you lost. Never mind. Have a good morning.
Yeah, see you later.
Okay, bye-bye. And hi there, we have about 45 seconds. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Goodbye. Okay, it's nice to have phones again. It really is. So, Lister, I'm not going to play an outro. You just sidle on in here. I'll remind people that we have the New York Review of Science Fiction readings this coming Tuesday here at 388 Atlantic Avenue with Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. And it's always a wonderful time. Admission is free. Donations are cajoled. And please show up. I'm sure that you will enjoy it. We've had really good crowds. And if you want to see a previous one, you go to livestream.com and do a search on NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction readings. But just NYRSF will show you about six or seven events that we've held so far. So do we hit something to begin? Are you going to talk or are you going to play your music?
You just hit the play button.
Ooh, that's a play button. Good morning, everybody. It is important, as I said, that you be good to each other, and at times like this, even more important than usual. Take good care.
That wants oppression of the truth, put on hold. The bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it, while I'm going off berserk. Cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others. Take the same turn like me, they yearn for the flag too. Born the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal, the American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison? Cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
Thinking it's slick, contradicting their own, taking me for a fool. They send my my man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn. What? Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America. America, home of the brave, land the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. The flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
When you wake up in the morning and it's you love is my lips. And I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue spit on you.
I'm to be the boss, but I just want to know that the Rolling Stones gathers no moss.
Yeah, yeah.
Come with double major, come with you, what I say. Lay me some music, I beg you, will you please play? Hey, I said I run the links, turn along, said this gather no moss. I roll the links, turn along, said this gather does none of no mala loss. I roll the links, turn along, said this gather does none of no mala loss. I roll the links, turn along, said this gather no moss. You shouldn't leave your yard and not eat breakfast. Me say you get dizzy and you faint in the past. Cause dirty nigga come and them a pass them remorse. I roll the links, don't say this gather's no moss. Step on for me, foot me on go with. Feel me clogs, a costume ball, you better put on your mask. Me love you drink me milk, but a strictly out of glass. So my mask like snake, ay, in a grass. But a rolling stone said it gather no mask. A rolling stone, it gather no mask. Me better than the DJ, Lord Sassafras. Every night in my dance, in my DJ boat ass. But this a DJ, say you know we my the boss, ay, cause this a DJ in a top of Norris class. I roll the Rolling Stone alone, said it gathers no mala loss. I roll the Rolling Stone, said it gather no moss. Hey, chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your bad saw. Chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your guan saw. Chum is a Irie, miss a Irie, make your bad saw. Right about now, some call it so. Say me on my way to Toronto. Say in a aeroplane, it was a jumbo. Me sit down by the seat, I look through the window. But little after that, me say me sight Ringo. Him say, hey, wait an Irie, we make your bad so. Cause rings by your finger, bells by your toe. Say when you DJ, your sound just like Sparrow. And when you are dance, it's just like Ladaro. On the aeroplane wing, me see a John Crow. And wing pan him, if him say that him a king. Him mouth it shape like he was saying hello. Chum Mr. Irie, Mr. Irie, make your bad saw. Chum Mr. Irie, Mr. Irie.